All right, we're ready to begin our second half then for this morning, and this time I'd like to welcome Dr. David Sharp, who is one of our professors here in the Division of Nursing. He is a professor in a number of different areas, but he also teaches mental health nursing, and he actually works with the American Psychiatric Nurses Association as an advisor with them, does some consultancy work, and is actively working in developing some protocols with teaching and advising in nursing nationally. And he has a wide range of experience in working with deluded clients in mental health environment. And we'll be looking at some of the themes that we have been talking about in the biblical context, but now taking this to how we work with deluded clients in the area of spiritual themes and applying some of the concepts that we've been talking about with Dr. Vincent. And then taking this further now to how does this relate to some of the themes that we've been discussing earlier, to how does this now relate to how we work with clients specifically in the area of mental health. And so at this time, I'd like to welcome Dr. David Sharp.
Thank you, Dr. Sharp. I'm going to start as well, like Dr. Vincent did, talking about my tie, because you started a theme here. So I've got a nicer tie than you, because it's all pretty and coloured and everything. Do you recognise it? Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh, right? Painted in the mental asylum in Saint-Rémy towards the end of his life. And it's said that had he been alive today, he'd been given phenothiazine medications that clients usually are given, this painting would not exist. So I wore that today just to remind us that there are some people with mental health problems who earn our respect and admiration and are greatly prized. Usually they're artists and things, but not always. And I'd like to lead on really from what Pastor Bob was saying about post-Kantian Western thought and the division between, the separation between the organic and the spiritual, and that being the kind of world that we live in, the modern world that we live in. And I'm going to give some thoughts about those two realms, the organic and the spiritual, and how they perhaps have related to me in my personal life, and to give some pointers to especially nursing students about how you might conduct yourselves in your personal life. I don't have any answers, really. And I think that's always frustrating for students who go through nursing courses and nursing programs, and they're usually given quite concrete information, and they come to mental health, and we've got no clue, really. Those of you that have been in my class already, we look at drugs, medications, and we look at things like risperidone, and there's thousands and thousands of words in the patient's advice leaflet that comes with it. And what's the one sentence that's really important there? We have no idea how this medication works. That's what the drug companies are telling us. We have no idea how this medication works. So if I had all the answers, I'd be very rich and I wouldn't be here. I'd be somewhere else. So that being the case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off by looking at some ideas about how we differentiate between the two realms, the organic and the spiritual, in our professional life, and then give you some examples from my own practice about where I've ended up in my thinking. So I'll do that using some overhead prompts, really, just to give you some information as well. I'm going to look, first of all, at some work by Pastor Stephen Waterhouse, who's written a book on Strength for His People, A Ministry for Families of the Mentally Ill. And it's written from the perspective of a Christian and written from a perspective of a Christian trying to help other Christians perhaps understand people with mental health problems. And there's six things that I thought were interesting to start with, to look at the things he brings out. The first one is six factors that differentiate between schizophrenia from demonic possession as described in the Bible. And Pastor Bob was talking about the fact that the Bible does not differentiate between the spiritual and the organic dimension. When people have a out of balance with their health or their normal relationships, it's all taken to be one. And many indigenous societies around the world still deal that way. That's why we study them from a cross-cultural perspective, it makes it very interesting. But in Western society, Western medicine, we still have this separation. So looking at that separation, how does Stephen Waterhouse draw these points apart? First of all, he says there's an attraction to versus and aversion of religion. He points out that demons want nothing to do with Christ. Conversely, people with a neurobiological brain disease, which is a kind of modern posh term for a mental health condition, are often devoutly religious. Pastor Bob talked about the fact he met many people in his congregation or people who were Christians who suffered from demon possession. Irrational speech versus rational speech. In the New Testament accounts involving demons, the demons spoke in a rational manner. Untreated people with schizophrenia will often speak in nonsense and jump rapidly between unrelated topics. Thirdly, he mentions ordinary learning versus supernatural knowledge. Demons in the New Testament would speak through people to convey knowledge that otherwise could not have been known to the possessed individuals. Those with a mental health condition, neurobiological brain disease, have no such ability to know facts, which they have not acquired by normal learning. The three other areas of dichotomy he points out, normal versus occult phenomena. There is an aspect of demon activity that is just plain spooky. For example, poltergeists, levitation, trances, telepathy. These have an impact on others in the room and not just the possessed. With schizophrenia, for example, the effects of the disorder is only on the disorder, not on other people. Fifthly, the claim to be possessed. Authors who have clinical experience both with demon possession and mental illness believe those who claim to be possessed are very likely not possessed. Demons wish to be secretive and do not voluntarily claim to be present. And lastly, he points out the effects of therapy. If prayer solves the problem, then it was probably not schizophrenia. If medicine helps alleviate the problem, it was not demon possession. So those are the sort of issues that Waterhouse points out that I think are helpful to formulate our thinking about what type of client we have, what their problem might be, etc. One of the examples I always like to look at when I'm looking at strange thinking that people have is going back a ways, back to the 1600s when the book by Cervantes was written on Don Quixote. When Don Quixote was being an errant knight trying to do things for the honour of his lady that he loved, and he's going around the country and he's seeing things and believing things that other people didn't believe. And one of the things he believed was that windmills were big giants. Now, I had hoped the audiovisual system would be working today, and Jeff said it wasn't working, but I took along a copy of Don Quixote, Hollywood movie, and if you look in that, there's a really good example of the Don Quixote chasing at the windmills, and the windmills turn into these big giants with arms and stuff like this, right? And we watch the movie and we can understand what his thinking is. We can understand that. When we're dealing with patients or people who are demon-possessed or have strange thinking, we don't have that advantage. We do not see where they've come from. We cannot get an idea of why they're thinking the way they're thinking or seeing the things they're seeing, so it's very difficult. However, Don Quixote was lucky in that one person was able to follow his thinking. In fact, join in his world, and that was Sancho Panza. Sancho Panza was his servant, the kind of opposite of Don Quixote. He looked differently. You just see the profile there. He's a little fat, dumpy guy on a mule, and Don Quixote is this magnificent errant knight on a stallion. They look completely different, right? But it's said that Sancho Panza was only able to enter into Don Quixote's world because he was a stupid man. Don Quixote was a crazy man. Right? He's going around the country doing things nobody else did and behaving really stupidly. And he had a servant who followed him and enabled him and supported him in that belief. And he was ignorant and naive. And Don Quixote promised Sancho Panza that he said, the first country that I conquer, you will be the king. Right? And he bought into that idea, right? But he was able to enter that world and engage with Don Quixote in that world and probably support him in that. So looking at the characteristics he had, Sancho Panza was ignorant and naive, but that ignorance and naivety allowed him to enter that strange world. So he was able to exist both inside and outside the world of Don Quixote. So he was able to actually make him survive in the world, because he didn't just go off into this crazy world on his own. Sancho Panza kept him in touch with the real world, so he could eat and he could sleep and he could do the things he needed to do to be active and to be a normal person, if you want. But at the same time, he inhabited this really, really strange world. So I like to look at that as an example of somebody we're all familiar with, or most of us are familiar with, that we know about Don Quixote, and we know he tilted at windmills, and we know he was strange thinking, and we know he had this servant who was a bit of a buffoon, but who helped enable him within that strange way of thinking. And then I compare that to my own experiences, and back when I started clinically, back in the 80s, and some experiences I had. I worked in a hospital that had been built in the 1800s. It was the second oldest hospital in Scotland, so it had a long track record. It was called the Royal Cornhill Hospital in Aberdeen. Now, it's called Royal. That means that it's had patients there who are from the royal family. That's why you get to call yourself a royal hospital. So the news is that Prince Harry's not the first crazy royal person they've ever had, right? You can forget about him. But there are people who are from the royal family who have been in mental hospitals. So, as we know, mental illness affects all strands of society. Now, the case study I'm going to tell you about involves myself when I was an RN. I'd been graduated just about a year or two. I was working in an acute admission ward in this hospital, which is situated just behind this building here. This building here is the dining room and the social therapy area. The units are behind it. I didn't have a photograph of the unit. And I was a shift manager, working in charge of one of the shifts. And we had a student came in as a patient in the acute unit, diagnosed as schizophrenic, as is quite common for people of about 20, 19, 20, 21 years old. He'd gone off to college, our college in Aberdeen, 500 years old. As Dr. Bob explained, he studied philosophy and stuff, ideas he'd not been exposed to before. And as we know with people with schizophrenia, that often unhinges something in them. And you start to have strange thoughts about philosophy and religion and stuff to such an extent it interfered with his normal daily living. That's why he came in as a patient. So he would come in and, for example, he was reading the Bible cover to cover, that's not unusual. But what he was doing, he was underlining or highlighting the word "the" every time it appeared. Now, that's not normal, right? He was just consumed with underlining the word "the" because it meant something special for him. He would also pray before he ate his food. Now, that's okay. A lot of us do that as well. But he would pray before every mouthful. Every time he chewed, he would pray. So it would take him maybe an hour and a half to eat his breakfast in the morning, right? So that interfered with him as well. Now, he was a Christian, young Christian person. He was part of the Christian Union in the university. I was an atheist at the time. So I had no connection with his way of thinking at all. And he had regular visitors from the Christian Union at the university. Some were students like him, and others, one or two were lecturers, were professors. And they would ask to spend time with him and pray and stuff. And as an atheist, I wasn't really interested in them doing that, but I let them do that, right? And then they came and they said, "We believe this patient is demon-possessed. We want to drive the demons out. We want to command the demons to leave him." And to me, that was like saying the guy wanted to go to Mars or something, right? As an atheist, it was just like completely crazy behavior. So we had a team meeting about it, and it was decided that by him joining in this exorcism, then that would be counterproductive to his treatment, and that it was actually enabling him in entering his delusional world and reinforcing the delusions. So as a team, we decided that we would not do that and would actively discourage that to happen. So when the professor came back the next time with a couple of people from the Christian Union, it was my job to say, "No, you can't do that. We're not allowing you to go into a room here and drive those demons out. We don't believe that's going to help him. In fact, we're going to discourage you from doing that." So they kind of argued back and forth about it, and we reached an agreement it wouldn't happen. And then he recovered a little bit somewhat, and they asked if they could take him to somebody's house for Sunday dinner and give him a meal there. And we said that would be okay. And then we found out later on they'd actually carried out an exorcism on him. And all the clinical staff were very annoyed and held the professor accountable and had a big argument about it. Now, you know, there's no happy ending on this. The person didn't dramatically get better. He did improve, and he did eventually go home. It took a long time. But the point I'm trying to make is it was my job to actively come between that person and the people from his church, if you want, who are trying to help him. And that was my professional role. And I kind of stuck with that role. I thought that was right to do that, because it was, we always have this rule that we don't encourage people's delusional behaviour. And it was, to me, delusional behaviour. He was a Christian. He might as well have been a Martian or something. Didn't mean anything to me. I couldn't understand him, right? And I think I kind of kept up that perspective. I mean, I became a Christian in the 1990s. And just about the same time, I started to do work, part-time work, for a distance university in Britain. It's called the Open University. And it's established to basically let people who haven't got degrees or who haven't got time to do degrees or want to change their degree or top up or whatever to gain accreditation and gain courses and things. And I started to work for them part-time. It's the biggest distance learning university in the world. It's bigger even than Phoenix or whatever it is over here, right? And when working there, I was really, it really helped me professionally as a teacher a lot. I worked for them for about 5 years. And I was recruited to teach on a course on mental health course, distance learning course. Now, anybody in the UK or even overseas could sign up to do this course. And I eventually became part of the course team, planning team and development team. But it meant that I did a lot of work over the phone with people. I'd hold 3 tutorials a year in different universities around the country. I was a kind of Scottish representative for this course. I would hold. Now, it was open to anybody, so we got a lot of nurses might do it. It became part of a social work degree program, the course, so we got a lot of social workers. But we also got clients, we got patients. It was open to anybody, they could come. So I'd go into a tutorial, I didn't know who was going to be there. There'd be 2-3 nurses, 2-3 members of the public, a couple of social workers, and maybe a couple of patients, right? Now, one of the people that helped develop the course was a patient. It was Ron Coleman, who, through my work on the program, I got to know, and I'd admired his work before I got to know him. I was very impressed with him. He was involved in some of the distance learning materials, helping to produce them, but also starring in them, because he was a schizophrenic. He was diagnosed as a schizophrenic. He was in the army, working late at night one night, and he hears a voice saying, "Why are you doing this? You're just stupid and ugly. What's happening?" And another voice joins in, another voice, and it really disturbs him. His wife had recently died, and a young child had recently died. He'd gone back to work, working late at night as an accountant for the army. Got very upset, went to his doctor and said, "You know, I've been under a lot of stress lately. I'm hearing these voices, you know." And he says, the doctor turned around to him and said, "You've got schizophrenia." And he says the amazing sense of relief he got, because he had a diagnosis. He's like, "Wow, this guy knows what's wrong with me. Fantastic." And the doctor says, "We're going to give you some medication that'll help you with the voices." Ron said, great. Took the medication, nothing happened. Back to the doctor. Doctor said, "Well, that medication's not working. And we know that medication only works with 1 in 3 chance, right? So he tries one another medication. That doesn't work." Eventually, Ron, cut a long story short, he's very disturbed, ends up in hospital, being kind of sedated and tied down, secluded and all that sort of stuff. Diagnoses a difficult schizophrenic patient. Until a new doctor comes on the unit and asks Ron to talk about his voices. And at that time, there's a movement started up called the Voice Hearers Network, and Ron's actually was the UK representative of it for a while. And it's basically saying it's okay to hear voices. Children hear voices all the time, right? And some adults do as well. And this came about because of a TV show in Holland, where there was a psychiatrist on, and they were talking about mental illness. And it was a bit like the Oprah show, is that what you call it? You know, like there's an audience in there, and they're all talking about stuff, you know? And he's describing, well, you know, people with schizophrenia, they're deluded, they've got strange belief systems, and they've usually got hallucinations, usually auditory hallucinations, and that's abnormal. And this lady in the audience says, "Excuse me, you know, I hear voices, and I'm at work, and I you know, I'm a regular person. Why'd you say anything wrong with me, you know?" And he's like, well, you know, some people might exist like that, whatever. So at the end of the show, they put an announcement up saying, we're going to do a special program, because this has become an issue, on hearing voices. If you think you hear voices, let us know, and we'll get you on the show, you know. Well, they got thousands and thousands and thousands of people wrote into the show. And the psychiatrist, I can't remember his name now, he came back on the show, and he's like, well, these people are all existing in the world. They're not in mental hospitals, you know. It's okay, it's part of their normal behaviour. So then they started looking at what people did with voices, and a lot of the people that were existing saying, well, you know, I switch them on and off when I want, or I command them to go, and they go, or I talk to them and stuff like that, and I feel comfortable with them, right? So then he started, made up this therapy about Voice Hearers Network, saying, you know, if we just can understand our voices, maybe it's okay. So Ron was part of that network, so he changed from being somebody who was heavily sedated in a unit to being somebody who was able to listen to their voices and exist in the world outside. So he got released from hospital or whatever, started working with the Voice Hearers Network, started doing a lot of kind of intervention therapies and stuff. And by the time I met him, he was actually a consultant working for the health services. Right? He worked 3 days a week for them. He had his own clinic in Coventry in England, and he worked in that clinic. And he gave a couple of really interesting examples of how, as an ex-patient, he understands the strange world of other people. He's like Sancho Panza with Don Quixote. He's able to understand that strange behaviour. And he gave two case studies that I always remember very clearly. The first was when one of his patients that he was working with came to him and said, I'm able to read people's minds, and it's really freaking me out just now, because I've got to the stage when I walk into my office, I'm just reading everybody's minds. I go on a bus, I'm reading everybody's minds. I go out in the evening, I'm reading everybody's minds. It's just freaking me out. Now, Ron's perspective is, well, the client's reality is always real. That is real, okay? So he says, okay, this guy's coming to me, he's a psychic mind reader. I don't know what a psychic mind reader is. I've no idea about that. So he asks around, and he finds out that in Edinburgh University, he's in England, but in Edinburgh University in Scotland, there's actually a degree course in paranormal psychology. It's the only one in the UK at that time. So he phones up the professor that runs this university course. He says, hey, I've got this guy I'm working with, and he's reading people's minds all the time, and he's just getting swamped with all the stuff he's getting from people's minds. And the paranormal professor goes, oh, yeah, he says, that's fairly common. It's called mind swamping or something. He says, what you've got to do is teach them to build a wall around themselves. Get up in the morning, build this wall, and that keeps the thoughts, everybody else's thoughts out. And then just get them to remove a brick at a time if they want to tune into MD. So Ron says, well, okay. So he goes back to the guy and he says, I've taken expert advice on this, and this is what you need to do. So they spent about a week training this guy just to build this wall around himself every day. Select bricks if you want to or not. Guy gets out. 2-3 weeks later, he comes back to see Ron. He says, back at work, no problems, on my life, absolutely nothing going on with me. You know, I'm absolutely fine. So Ron says, well, it's worked. You know, the person's reality is the reality. The other example he gave is one of the people who was resident in the unit got cleared up, if you want. He was back in his own rational self. Got back home, and he started his own business, cooking some lunches and delivering lunches around the offices. He'd go around and take an order. He'd come back every few days and deliver lunches 3 days a week. And he'd come in when they were having their team meetings and give out the lunches at lunchtime, whatever, and they'd be all sitting there. And Ron would say to him, how's it going for you? Things going okay? And he'd say, yeah, it's okay, it's going at home, but, you know, my upstairs neighbour's going to kill me, so, you know. And he's like, yeah, whatever, you know. So a couple of times he said this, Ron would say, how's it going? He'd say, fine, here's your lunch. Just a bit worried about neighbour, he's going to kill me, right? And 1 week, the guy doesn't come in with the lunches, because what's happened to him? Upstairs neighbour killed him, right? He's in his flat one day, there's a knock at the door, guy opens the door, his upstairs neighbour just plunges a knife in his chest, kills him outright, right? And Ron feels really guilty about this. He says, I should have known that person's reality is always correct. When he's coming in with my lunch and telling me his upstairs neighbour's going to kill me, I should quit my business that I'm doing around the table with everybody and sit down with him and talk to him about the fact that why has he got these fears and where's it going from? So talking to Ron, working with Ron, kind of helped me change my perspective on what I'd been doing clinically. And the thing that I learned from working through the Open University with clients and with people like Ron is that the reality of the client is always correct. It is real for them. It's absolutely real for them. It's not our reality. It might not be my reality. It might be not anything like what I imagine it to be. I cannot imagine getting on a horse and chasing windmills, trying to bring them down. It just makes no sense to me. But that was real for Don Quixote. We don't have to agree with that. We don't have to enter that person's world to agree with it and say that it's something that we should encourage. But we've got to try and understand that reality. We've got to try and figure out what's real for that person. The guy with the psychic mind reading, when Ron was able to understand that, he could help him. The guy who was killed by his neighbour, he should have tried to understand that situation he was in and deal with that as well. So if we can understand the reality, then we can start to help the clients, right? So the big issue here is that if a client is possessed by demons, and students often ask me this when I'm on clinical with them, they'll say, do you believe clients are possessed by demons? And I'll say, if the client says they're possessed by a demon, they are possessed by a demon. That's their reality. It's like Don Quixote, it's like a psychic mind reader, it's like the guy going to get killed by his neighbour, whatever. They are possessed by demons. Pastor Bob gave two good examples earlier this morning, right? The old lady that he dealt with in that wood, and the things he saw there. And the question I would have for Pastor Bob, I'll put out there now for you, the question I was, what did you see in that wood? What did you hear? And what did you see? Because you mentioned that a couple of times. I was kind of fascinated as to what that actually looked like. I'd like you maybe to come back on that at the end. That'd be great. And the other example he gave was the demon he experienced when that young lady was in his office. And that was a real demon for him. That was a reality that he faced. So if the person has got a demon, they've got a demon. Now, it leads us on to look at a couple of ways we can deal with that professionally. Okay, the person's got a demon. What do we do with that? What do we do with that professionally? Recap some stuff that I do in some of the classes. So some of you might be familiar with this. We've all got NCLEX exams to sit, and we know that reality orientation is always going to be the right answer, textbook answer, right? It's what professional nurses do. So the little old lady is wandering the corridor, and she comes up to you and she says, I got to leave now, because my mother's coming home from work to get her dinner, right? The correct answer to that, as we've talked about in some classes, the correct answer to that is always going to be textbook answer. You're a little old lady who's confused in a hospital. Let's go and sit down and have a chat, right? However, over the years, it's been noticed that the best nurses, the nurses that have the most impact with clients, don't always do that, right? What they do is they have another answer. When the little old lady says, I've got to go home and get dinner ready because my mother's coming home from work. Good nurses would always say, well, you know what? Your mother just called to say she's going to be a little bit late from work, so we'll go and sit over here and have a chat in the meantime until she comes back, right? So the validation was seen to be effective. Now, nurses in Canada about 20 years ago or so noticed this and said, what's going on here? You know, we're all interested in evidence-based practices. Nurses, we investigate what's the best practice for us and based on research and things. So they start to say, well, you know, care assistants and people that have been ignoring the textbooks have been doing this forever, and it seems to work. It calms people down. So what's going on? And what they noticed was that when you enter the world of the client, then it was more effective than always taking them into reality. Because if you've got someone who's confused or upset and you're giving them a reality that's uncomfortable, they're going to get more and more confused and upset, you know. So saying to the little old lady, you're a little old lady who's off her head and you're in the hospital, she's going to get, no, I'm not, I want to go home and see my mother, blah, 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 and get all upset, you know. Whereas nurses would have non-medication type of ways to calm people down, right? So the two different approaches. In reality orientation, the client enters the world of the nurse, the real world. Now, sometimes for some clients, that's really important. We've got to do that, especially people who we know are going to go home again, right? They've got to function in the real world. Don Quixote had Sancho Panza. He could feed him, he could look after him. It wasn't an issue for him. I ran a dementia unit. It was a dementia rehabilitation unit. We called it a rehabilitation unit, because our objective was always to put people back home. Now, it very rarely happened that would happen, but that was our objective, to keep people at a high level of function independently. So initially, when people came in and were confused and upset and things, we would orientate them to reality and say, no, 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 this is what the real world looks like. To go in the real world, you've got to do these things and get out there. So we push that. However, if that's too upsetting for people or not appropriate, then the nurse, the health professional, has got to enter the world of the client, and that's an altered reality. So how does that affect us with demon possession? Well, from a nursing perspective, it doesn't really matter the difference between the organic and the spiritual world that Dr. Bob mentioned. The reality is the reality. And the patient doesn't know or doesn't care if it's organic or spiritual. It's something they're dealing with, right? So they might be real from a Christian perspective that Dr. Bob mentioned earlier on about our understanding. Or they might not be. They might be real in that they're part of a delusion system. But from our perspective, it doesn't really matter. The fact is that's their reality. It's the psychic mind reading. It's a person who's going to get killed, whatever. It is something that's real and is going on with them, right? Therefore, reflecting back, in 1992, I was operating under reality orientation. I thought that's what I should be doing, especially with someone who had a belief system I didn't buy into, right? I couldn't really see where they were going with it. So as a ward manager, there's things I should have done. I should have accepted that the demons were real for the person. I did not think they were real demons. I thought they were deluded, just like if they turned around and said they were President of America or the reincarnation of Jesus Christ or someone. I just thought that they were totally had to be shot down and dealt with, right? What I should have done was used a validation approach. If I'd done that and understood the person, I might have been more effective in my way of looking after them, because I would have probably provided a room for the client and his friends to drive out the demons. So when I go back and look at Don Quixote, now look at that crazy man, and we know he'd an enabler, and that enabler was seen to function in that role because he was a stupid man. In fact, he wasn't being a stupid man, he's been a therapeutic man. He's been a person who was actually able to help Don Quixote to deal with what he's going through, right? So instead of seeing him as a crazy man, Sancho Panza's saying, this guy's reality is real. I don't understand it. You know, I see the things he's doing, but I can understand where he's coming from because it's very real for him. So instead of him being ignorant and naive, if we are taking that position that we're given to enter the world of someone who's got an altered reality, then we've got to be validating and understanding, right? And we no longer look naive and gullible, but we're doing it from a professional point of view. And I think that's a big difference nowadays, is that before, in the time when Cervantes wrote Don Quixote in 1615 or whatever it was, all the way through several hundred years after that, anyone who's agreed with someone who's got an altered reality is seen as being naive and stupid. Whereas in fact, we've got to go there to understand things, and if we understand things, then we can better help them. So for nurses, we need to do that, especially if we're assessing people. We haven't seen someone before, we don't know them, and they tell us things that just seem very, very strange, right? The example I give is when I was working in a care of the elderly unit. I was a unit manager there, and we used to run reminiscence groups. As the students have noticed, when they're working with clients with dementia and things, the long-term memory is usually pretty good. You can't remember what they had for breakfast, and they'll confabulate that. But they'll remember what they did way back when. So we had groups, and we had one group maybe for World War II people. There were people that worked in World War II or were veterans. And when a patient came into the unit, I think I've told the story to some students, patient came into the unit, a little old lady, she's kind of all bent up, you know, come walking in. We said, we've got a reminiscence group. Do you want to come and join it today? Oh, yes, I'll do that, you know. Says, it's about World War II. Do you remember World War II? Oh, yeah, yeah. So we go around the table, and people explain, and mostly women in the group, and they'd worked in munitions factories, and they'd done various things, you see. Now, this lady had just come into the unit. We didn't really know her. She'd come in her own. We hadn't talked to any relatives yet. They lived at some distance. So around the group, we had props like gas masks and things they could talk about. And we said to her, her name was Liz. Liz, what did you do in the war then? And she goes, I used to fly Spitfires. You know, Spitfire's like an F-16 or something, like high-tech fighter plane. We're like, okay, you did what? She goes, I used to fly Spitfires. We're going, okay. Deluded, you know. So, okay, well, look at the gas mask. Tell us if you remember the gas mask and all this stuff, you know. So that Saturday, her son comes up from England to visit her because she just moved into hospital. And we're saying, you know, we're assessing her, using him. And we say, your mother, you know, we've got this reminiscence group about the war. And could you give us some clue as to what she did in the war? We'll maybe use that as a conversation next time. And he says, oh, she used to fly Spitfires. I'm like, huh? He says, yeah, he says, all the men were off fighting the Germans and Japanese. And he says, when they finished a Spitfire in a factory, they needed people to deliver them. So they had trained women to fly these Spitfires to the airfields. He says, in fact, she flew the first Spitfire that came to the city of Aberdeen. He says, I'll bring in photographs. And he sent us photographs from newspapers. And there's the Spitfire landing on the flying field. And she's coming out with the goggles and stuff. First Spitfire delivered to defend Aberdeen. She's there, you know. And it's that's one of the things that always, you know, before I met Ron, I'd always think, you know, maybe sometimes when patients say things, it's actually real. It is real before I got to that. Good example this week, actually. Jasmine? Jasmine and I have been on clinical this week. And maybe tell a little story about what happened to us this week.
Good morning. I'm Jasmine Wheatley. I'm a senior AVSN student here at LC, and I was in clinical rotation with Dr. David Sharp. Well, during my clinical rotation, I came in contact with a client that's 84 years old, female, and she complained of bugs coming out of her skin. Well, I didn't read her chart. It was advised not to read the client's chart prior to meeting the client because it can create a bias. And I wanted to be able to properly assess and objectively assess the client and use the validation approach that Dr. David Sharp talked about. Well, in order to make the client feel comfortable, I took two opportunities to completely assess the client. One was during the use of her toiletries and during her social consult. Well, I found that she did have evidence of bite marks on both lower extremities, posterior and anterior. Well, I sat and I talked with the client, and she told me that she did not report it because when she did, they labeled her. So she didn't want to report it again. I told her that I would report it and, you know, help her with the pain that she was experiencing. Well, after I reported it to the nurse, I did read her chart, and she was classified as a paranoia schizophrenic that suffered with delusions and hallucinations. And it was listed in her chart that she complained of bugs coming out of her skin. So it is very important to first assess your clients and also validate what they are telling you, because as you said, it can be real. As the day went on, I did speak with a nurse before I left, and she did come back to me and let me know that she did assess the client and she did find bite marks on her and that she would report it to the psychiatrist later that afternoon. So it is important to validate and assess your clients prior. We are still the client's advocate, and sometimes what they say can be real. It is not all made up. It is not all delusional. It is not all hallucinations. Thank you.
One of the things that Jasmine pointed out there, I mean, I know we do in communication class with juniors, so we've all done this, is that labels in mental health are sticky labels. You know, when you get that sticky label, you can't peel it off, right? So when that person is diagnosed as being delusional because she thinks there's bugs on her skin, then that's a label she has. And even though Jasmine found, and it was good work, Jasmine found, in fact, the woman had bugs on her skin. That was real, you know. But that woman will be still stuck with that label. And the other thing that points out is what one of the terms we talked about when I worked in the Open University from another one of my colleagues was what's termed deviancy amplification. If you're deviant in any way from normal, then anything you do is seen in that context, right? So if you're a manic depressive and you get up in the morning and it's raining and you feel a bit sad, then that's because of your manic depression. It's not because of the weather, right? If you're a manic depressive and you're a New Orleans fan, right, and they happen to beat Green Bay Packers this weekend, which is highly unlikely, but if they do that and you're happy, then you're manic, right? So whenever you've got a mental health label, anything you do is seen within that context, right? Your deviancy is amplified and everything you do is centered around that. So looking at the validation approach that Jasmine talked about there, what real nurses do, real mental health nurses do, which I didn't do. I wasn't a real mental health nurse back there. I was just a gatekeeper. I was a prison officer or something. I was a custodian. I wasn't actually being therapeutic with anybody. I spent most of my time just controlling people. That was my job, right? But validation, the nurse enters the world of the client. Now, that's an altered reality. It might not be comfortable for us to be there. Client may be schizophrenic. They might be deluded. Or they might be possessed by demons, as Pastor Bob talked about. Whatever it is, the reality is real, and we must understand that to be able to help them, because eventually we want to take them to where we are in the real world, right? And those of you that have been on clinical, I think with Mr. Don as well, he uses it as we use a case study from the Bible. We use Mark chapter 5 and Jesus and the man named Legion. And again, I hope to have a little audio clip, a video clip, and I wasn't able to do that today, but there's a site online you can get called GodTube, like YouTube, but GodTube. And they've got some really nice little vignettes from the Bible. They actually have animated stories, and one of them is on Jesus and the man named Legion. And you'll see Jesus here with a man falling at his feet. He's naked. And just to paraphrase the story, we know that when he crosses the sea there, and he finds this man who's living in the tombs, isn't he? He's chained, and he breaks his chains, and he cuts himself, and screams out all the time. And Jesus drives out the demons, and they go into the pigs, and they all fall off the cliff. And what's the reaction of the shepherds of the pigs? They're all terrified. It's like, who is this crazy guy? He's making pigs jump off cliffs. You know, it's a really strange, very strange, scary story. I love reading that story. It's an amazing story. And then they ask Jesus to leave. He's like, hey, what are you doing here driving our pigs? You know, we want rid of you. You're just a menace to society. And then Jesus, when they come back, and they come back to the disciples, he drove off the demons. And look at the example he gives here. He drove out the demons, and then he sat down and had a conversation with them. And there's a model for us. Drive out the demons, and then sit, and you can talk to people, right? When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They weren't amazed, they were afraid. What an amazing, powerful thing to see, to witness, right? And he asked to go with Jesus, doesn't he? He said, let me come with you. What does Jesus tell me to do? No, go and tell people what's happened to you. And he goes around to Decapolis, he goes around to 10 cities telling people, and people are like, who is this guy? Was this not the crazy guy, you know? Possessed by demons and stuff. He's changed. So I think Christ gives an example. We've got to drive out the demons. And there's different ways we can do that. We can do it through exorcism. We can do it through medicines or whatever. Whatever it takes to get the person to a point where they think they don't have the demons anymore. And then we can talk to them. Yeah. Christ gives us that example. No point in talking to them beforehand. I should have, with my patient, allowed his friends to drive out the demons. And then I could have sat and talked to him. But I didn't want to engage in a conversation with him because I thought he was going somewhere I didn't feel comfortable with. The whole issue of exorcism is controversial, and I did not want to go there as a professional because I thought it was perhaps harmful to reinforce the delusions I felt the client had. That is a contentious issue. And there's a movie I directed towards. I was probably not getting time to show a clip today, but it's The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Emily? Some of you have seen that movie. And it's a true story. It's based on a true story about this person. Her real name is Annalise Michel. And the film centres around her priest being prosecuted for neglect because she eventually died. She thought she was possessed by demons. And there was actually, in real life, there were four people prosecuted, but in the Hollywood movie, they concentrate on one. All four were found guilty of negligent homicide, sentenced to 6 months in prison, suspended for 3 years probation. She forced herself to fast because she believed it would rid her of Satan's influence. At the time of her death, she weighed only 68 pounds. Prior to her death, she had spoken of dying to atone for those sins of the wayward youth, of her wayward youth. And the ways of the church had gone recently. According to her autopsy on July 1st, 1976, Annalise Michel succumbed to the effects of severe dehydration and malnourishment. At the time of her death, she was also suffering from pneumonia with a high fever. She's buried next to her sister. So, kind of shocking pictures of her, and that story has been turned into a movie. There's also a German version of this movie called Requiem, which is maybe less kind of scary than this one is. I found, thinking, reflecting back Pastor Bob's comments this morning, you know, I think myself as a scientific person, very rational. I'm a Christian, and yet when I look at images from this film, and when I look at pictures, and I look at stuff I've been researching on this, I find it a little bit unhinging, I would say, challenging almost, and almost a reluctance on my part to look at it, because I think, as was pointed out this morning, it's letting me know how vulnerable I am to demons, and maybe not so much demon himself as in Satan sitting on my shoulder, but the demons that I'm susceptible to, the small demons as well as the big demons. And I think that's, that reality for me is a little bit strange and frightening, and that's maybe what makes horror movies so popular and scary. People do get scared, and I was like, yeah, I've been rational, yeah, I'll maybe get a clip to show, and I'm looking at clips and I'm thinking, man, that's scary stuff to look at, right? I had another couple. If you go to YouTube, there's also clips of, for example, women in Russia being exorcised by priests and stuff, and that's a little bit challenging to look at as well. So if you're interested, I would advise you to go there. But what am I trying to say here? Maybe I was frightened that if I entered that patient's world in 1983, I'd end up with someone like this who I would fuel his delusions to such an extent he would not be able to function. He stopped eating and drinking, actually, and became very catatonic and mute. And eventually he got ECT, which helped him a little bit. Maybe not. But anyway, I'll just finish up where I started by going back to Stephen Waterhouse. He had 6 points at the beginning. I'll finish up by looking at a summary of what he comes out with. How to differentiate demon possession from schizophrenia. He says, schizophrenia can strike anyone, including individuals from deeply religious homes. The concepts of devils, heaven and hell are part of Christian belief. Demonic influences are rare, but integral part of many. And many Christians who research schizophrenia wonder about the demonic. Is my relative possessed? The New Testament mentions demons over 100 times. And then the other point he makes is that even those who have other beliefs or choose to remain sceptical still must relate to Christians who do believe in the supernatural, which I did not do as a professional. I did not relate to them. Many Christians who endure a family member's battle with schizophrenia will have questions about demonic involvement with a loved one and deserve real answers instead of a condescending response which dismisses such concern as nonsense on the part of ignorant people. We started off by looking at Sancho Panza as being an ignorant man, but maybe he wasn't so ignorant really. He was maybe just being empathetic and concerned. And maybe that's what we need to be as well. If you want further information, just email me. Okay, thanks.